Hey, what's up, Brian?
You know, I'm at the field BC room. I'm about to moderate my where are you at? Is there what? Yeah. Where are you at? Oh,
this is the teacher's
chair. Yeah. But it's all good.
Thank you.
Are you coming later or are you just chilling around now? I figured that was going to be my biggest job, kind of be an asshole about that. So. Yeah, I figured that was the biggest part of the job.
I'm going to shut the door. I'm going to get out of the house.
Yeah. I try to make it all somehow mixed together.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll stick that out.
Yeah.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Oh, do you?
Okay. Yeah. I'm nice.
Okay. You can be good. And then I'm
sorry,
I'm
right
here. Yeah. How's Chicago DC treating you?
I'm fine.
It's like when you actually do mass work, it's not just sort of like comparing positions online.
Like when I walk in, like a lot of
yeah, I'd be happy to.
Did you bring books?
Dave got them in the book room. I didn't grab one, so. You should sign a book. Like, you should sign
a book. You brought
books. I didn't prop. I had
all the time.
It was so good. It's such a good, it's such a good visual.
Yeah.
I love it.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, good. Good enough, but I actually need a pen after because of accident when I get to. I was woefully unprepared, though, thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, actually.
start in about 1 minute, so man your battle stations and get ready to start in just a minute. I got one. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. How's everybody feeling? Feeling good? I said, how's everybody feeling this afternoon? All right. Socialism 2019. This is my first time actually at one of these. This is amazing. So, hello, everybody. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Diego Morales. I'm a member of the DSA here in Chicago. And today, we're going to be talking about socialists and the teacher strike wave that's been making, headlines and spark a lot of debates and conversations. So I would like to introduce Eric Blanc. Eric Blanc is the author of the book Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave, and the Working Class Politics. Amazing. By the way, it's available in the book room up front for purchase, and Eric will stay after the talk today to answer any questions or talk with any of y'all that would like to do that. Eric Blanc is a journalist and a former high school teacher. He's appeared on Democracy Now! And has written for The Nation, The Guardian. During the Los Angeles, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, Denver, and Oakland, public education strikes, Blanc has been Jacobin Magazine's on-the-ground correspondent. And to his right, we have Jillian Russom. Jillian Russom has been a high school history teacher in Los Angeles for 18 years. She's a member of the board of directors of United Teachers Los Angeles. She was a longtime member of the ISO and contributed to the book Education and Capitalism. So thank you both for being here. So these strikes have been hitting headlines for a little while now, like I said, sparking conversations and debates. I just wanted to ask you both, can you explain why you think these teacher strikes are such a big deal? And you can start with Eric.
Yeah. So can you all hear me?
Yeah.
So I used to be a teacher, so I'm going to subject you to a few visual aids to just give a sense of this. So this is a chart of the number of educators that went on strike in 2018. So you can see this extremely dramatic increase up until about 400,000 educators on strike, which is just bonkers, right? This is by far the largest in the history of the United States. And so what we're talking about is a very significant historic development, the largest number of strikers in general since 1986, and really the first time in a long time that the labor movement has put the strike back on the table for working people, right? Because our side's been getting our asses kicked for four decades, and for the first time, teachers took the lead, female teachers took the lead to show that, like, our strongest weapon is to withhold our labor. So this, you know, this poses a question for really the working class as a whole, and it poses the question for educators in particular about how are we gonna roll back, you know, decades of neoliberalism, privatization, resegregation. And so part of the strike wave that's so significant is that they've won important victories, and one of the important victories that they've won is that they have systematically shifted the public conversation around public education. And so this is my visual aid here. Next one. This is the covers of Time magazine in 2008-2014. Does anyone who's in front see who this is? Right there, this is Michelle Rhee. You can hiss if you want. Yes. There you go, hissing is good. So that, according to Time magazine, is how to fix America's schools, which is basically privatization, union busting, charters. And then this was Time magazine in 2014 saying, rotten apples, it's nearly impossible to fire a bad teacher. Some tech millionaires may have found a way to change that. So this was the narrative until just the teacher strikes. And what the teacher strike did, they said that was BS, that the reason the schools are in the shape they're in is not because the teachers are unions, but it's because the billionaires have been systematically defunding the schools. And so because of the teacher strikes, that narrative began to shift. This is my last visual. I see Time magazine this last year. I have a master's degree, 16 years of experience, work two extra jobs, and donate blood plasma to pay the bills. I am a teacher in America. And you don't get that type of shift in popular consciousness without mass strikes. So I think that in short, this is one of the big reasons why it's an extremely exciting time to be a teacher or to be a labor activist.
Hi, everyone. That stuff's awesome. And I think, having been a socialist for quite a while and talking a lot of times in the abstract about the rise of worker struggle and worker struggle as a solution, the huge increase in strikes is obviously why this is so important to all of us. We have such a concrete example of the kind of movement we need. I think the second thing that makes these strikes so important has to do with social justice, workers and social justice. So, I don't know if people have had a chance to hear Emily Comer, the West Virginia teacher, but she just encapsulated the fact that teachers, basically we see the entire crisis that the working class is facing, we see that every single day. And so, not only that, but teachers had the greatest economic downward mobility since the 70s of any profession. But more importantly, just what we see every day as far as the number of, she talked about the opioid crisis, we see poverty, we see racism, And so the fact that these strikes really showed that workers' power, worker strikes can actually raise the full range of issues that face the working class and be a vehicle for a beginning to address reinvestment in abandoned communities. I think it's amazing. And then just having a chance to be on strike, I've read and written about strikes for a really long time. It was fucking awesome to finally be on strike. And just like if people had a chance to be on picket lines, like if you believe in a better world and then you get a chance to see your colleagues, people that have felt so isolated and beat down for so long, actually feel empowered. Just a short example, in LA we had big citywide rallies that were massive, and then we had this one day of regional rallies, and on the east side we shut down the major street on the east side of LA. It was raining, people were dancing in the streets, and we shut a street down on behalf of our students. And my coworker turned to me and said, "This feels like freedom." You know, and you got this sense that for once in our lives, we're working our asses off, but we're doing it for our class and, you know, our people. And just, I think there are lots of ways in which people are not going to forget that experience, you know, and hopefully more people get a chance to be on strike. Lastly, I agree with like Lois Weiner saying this was a feminist victory. You know, we're talking about a profession that's been systematically disrespected because of sexism. Because the work with young people is considered unimportant, less important, and always devalued, right? And the fact that women were at the forefront of these strikes and were actually revitalizing the core importance of this work in our society, I think is another thing that makes it really important.
All right, thank you guys again. So the next question we have is that racial divisions have long been one of the central roadblocks for building a strong movement in defense of public education. How did the organizers help confront and overcome these divisions during the strike? And this time we can start with you, Lane.
Okay, cool.
I'm gonna speak mostly about LA. Our student body in LA is 82% black and brown, 73% Latino students. And so the issues impacting our schools have a lot to do with racism. So if you look at California, people probably know that in the 60s, California schools were the best in the country, some of the best in the world, some of the best funded, right, public schools. Due to tax reform, since that time, our schools are, you know, we're 44th in the nation out of 50 states in per pupil funding. That's all under Democrats for the most part. But that's also as the number of students of color in our state has grown. And I think that's not a coincidence. The abandonment of students in public schools in California has a lot to do with the fact that they're increasingly students of color. In terms of strategy for taking on racial justice and racial divisions, the group that decided to take over our union in 2014, called Union Power, we worked with a nationwide, pretty small network, but we saw racial justice had to be a key part of transforming our union. So that was intentional. But I wanna say that other groups that work for racial justice were a key part of pushing us. So there was a group that was formed of focusing a lot on high school student activism and called Students Deserve. They're an amazing group. And those kids said one of their key concerns was the fact that they're pulled out of class and searched with metal detectors for no reason in class. The schools in LA with the most black and Muslim students were getting searched the most. So they actually have fought around that issue for quite some time and got us to take that up. They did that in coalition with Black Lives Matter. Part of the lesson here is union work shouldn't be in a silo. You have to be like really listening to social justice advocates outside the union. We had a lot of debates around becoming a union that would take up racial justice. It didn't like just happen because it was a good idea. So we had fights with people on our board of the union saying we shouldn't ally with Black Lives Matter. When Parkland happened, you had people in our union saying, you know, we really have to focus on supporting school police. They went so far as a small subgroup of our union having a pro-police rally in the valley. The day before, high school students were doing a town hall forum on ending the random searches. And so we had to fight that out. We denounced what they did. Not very many teachers showed up to the pro-police rally, by the way, and like there were 1,000 people at the student-led rally. But we had to fight these things out, and it was very much vindicated in our strike, because you could feel that the community support, we had 82% community support, was due to the fact that we had a social justice message and we were speaking for our students. I just want to say one last thing, because our union is also majority teachers of color. We're one of the few teachers unions in the country that is. We're about 2/3 teachers of color, 43% Latino. And a lot of young teachers of color had just really felt not listened to by the union for a long time. And because we reframed a racial justice message as part of our strike, you had teachers of color really in the forefront of a lot of it, and actually saying that it was an identification with students of color that brought them into teaching, and they actually felt that this strike was a continuation of that.
So, yeah, so I want to basically agree with everything Jelaine said and take a step back to one of the crucial things about the strikes in general that made them so successful and have made them so successful is that they were strikes not on behalf only of the people who went on strike, but really for the working class as a whole. And that's not the norm in the labor movement. So, you know, people within labor call this bargaining for the common good, but, you know, you can call it social justice unionism, but really that informed the spirit of all of the strikes. And it informed the drive in which it was able to build this unity. And I thought one of the really remarkable and somewhat unexpected aspects was the extent to which students of color took the lead on this in a really remarkable way. So just to give an example, in Denver, some people might have seen this. Some of the students there organized a walkout in support of their teachers. And it was really crucial because in most of the blue cities or states from which we live, as a lot of you probably know, the privatizers used the rhetoric, in Los Angeles as well, used the rhetoric of racial justice to push through charter schools, privatization, and they're able to point to admittedly real inequities in the education system, right? But the solution they give is, you know, bring in private capital. And so to combat that, the students of color, you know, you can look at the videos, I can send you links after if you're interested, Johnny Palmer and Alessandro Chavira, who like led this really semi-spontaneous Facebook-driven walkout of students across the city were crucial to winning the strikes. Some of you might have seen, they organized actually instead of walking out before school, they had everyone go into school to show that the school couldn't function without the teachers there, and it became a health hazard, and then it became a spontaneous dance party where people danced to Mo Bamba. Did anyone see this video in Denver? It kind of went viral, and it was literally after that that the district capitulated because it was like, you know, students gone wild or something. But it showed that this, you know, the students actually took the lead, and they did that explicitly by saying, we need an alliance with our teachers for good public schools, and it's through that how we're gonna build actually the schools that we need, and we're gonna combat the racial inequities. So there's that. And I would just say generally, if you look at the Arizona strike, people don't talk about it that much, but if there was one place where you might not have expected there to be a successful statewide strike going into this, I would have said Arizona's my top three because of the history of, you know, open white supremacism and xenophobia that a lot of us associate the state with. And the Red for Ed movement there, it might seem small, but every single Red for Ed sign and every single rally, every single thing was bilingual. Right, and in a place like Arizona, that's a very big deal, right? And it was a very consciously inclusionary movement. The demands weren't generally, they weren't explicitly anti-racist, but the movement as a whole was very inclusive and really oriented towards bringing in everybody and not just white teachers, but, you know, students of color who are the majority of the student body. And they, you know, they even spread to the reservations and to have the thing called Res for Ed in Arizona. And I think we can look at these examples, and it shows, I'll just end with this, that the way we're going to win large numbers of white workers to anti-racist politics isn't just by making the argument, but it's by bringing them into struggle. Because you had teachers in Arizona who voted for Trump, but then who allied with black and brown students and teachers to fight for their interests. And it was in that process that anti-racist organizers were able to win them to a different type of politics, to see that it was billionaires, not immigrants, that were really at fault for all the problems in their lives. So I think that's important, because it's going to take struggle to really change a lot of consciousness.
All right, so for this next one, we'll start with you, Eric. So what was the role of socialists in preparing and building for the strikes vis-a-vis their relationship with caucus building, union leadership, and did this look different in red states versus blue states?
Yeah, so it's extremely exciting, the moment we're in, partly because you have a strike wave, and partly because the strike wave has had socialists take a leadership role. And that is new, and you know, as a lot of you probably know, the labor movement in the 1930s was spearheaded in many ways by socialists, and that's one of the reasons they kicked us out of the unions. And so the big dilemma for our side for so long has been how to reconnect the socialist movement with the labor movement, because both have suffered a lot because of this forcible divorce. And so just to give the example of West Virginia, some of you might already know the story, but it's worth repeating because it's very important. The initial organizing that ended up culminating in the West Virginia strike was born of a DSA educator study group in Charleston, West Virginia, of a DSA chapter that arose in the wake of the Bernie Sanders campaign, because Bernie won every single county in West Virginia. And Jay O'Neill and Emily Comer, some of you who know them, were lovely comrades, did a study group with Jane McAlevey's book, No Shortcuts, which is a kind of strategy document on how to build working class power. And they did their best to implement that strategy within West Virginia. Unfortunately, they don't lead the union yet, but they pushed as far as they could go. They were able successfully to build up enough power from below to force their union to call a strike vote, and then to force the union to strike, and then force the union to continue, or to force actually to go wildcat, as some of you remember, right? And without this rank and file socialist-led push from below, there's no way you would have had the strike in the first place, in my opinion, and really opinion of folks on the ground. And it wasn't just socialists. Clearly, socialists on their own, this small group, wouldn't on their own have been able to like lead a mass strike. They had to meet up and link up with people who came out of the like southern counties where there's a mine workers tradition. And so socialists have always been part of a broader layer of militant fighters. But without the initiative of this core group of activists, I don't think you would have seen the strike, not just in West Virginia, but in also in Arizona. And I'll just, before passing it to LA, I think it's worth noting that the actual context through which this very small group of socialists was able to play an outsized role isn't the same in every state. In places like West Virginia or Arizona or a lot of the red states, there's a political vacuum because the unions are so weak, there's not collective bargaining, strikes are illegal, and so there was a political vacuum that this small group of socialists was able to fill. I think in a place like where I live, New York or California, the actual process through which socialists are able to build up working class power takes a lot longer. The bureaucracy is a lot stronger in the union movement, the Democratic Party is in power. So the forms that the movement will take through which socialists can lead is going to look different in a red state or blue state. It's worth keeping that in mind, because I think some people get disappointed that if they just go out and create a Facebook page and not everyone's on strike, you know? And so I do think that it's worth really being very context specific for what we think about our social strategies.
That's really helpful transition to what I wanted to talk about, because it was a very long and difficult process to transform UTLA that we made a lot of mistakes. Socialists, like a small group of socialists, has been involved in trying to build a rank and file caucus for a long time, at least 15 years in UTLA with a broader group of militants, but not that big. Of 20 to 30 people trying to build a caucus with a different vision of what our union could be like over a long period of time. Part of what makes it difficult in a state where you've had a union for a long time and it's just been led in such a crappy top-down way is it just creates a lot of passivity where people don't really feel like they can change it or they have a role to play. And so, you know, it has actually never been that easy for us to engage people in the caucus. But the Chicago strike, now we are living in an era where if you're in a teachers union, you have tons of examples to point to of how things can be different. In 2012, we had one example, and that was the Chicago strike, which was led in an anti-racist way around the schools our students deserve. So what we did was we actually took advantage of this little loophole in our union constitution, and we brought a member referendum for the whole union to vote on. Let's do a campaign for the schools LA students deserve. Let's basically copy Chicago's strategy, which is diametrically opposed to what we're doing right now in LA, which was nothing, even as thousands were laid off post-recession. I mean, really tragic stuff was going on. And that laid that platform where we said, we want this different way, that laid the basis for our folks winning election. And again, not all socialists. The person who's president of UTLA is a socialist. Small group of socialists were involved in that project. But I just want to say then the debates didn't end, like I mentioned before. So part of our role as radicals has been just to fight about what was needed to get us in that situation. So what is the role of staff in our union? We had to fight over that. Do staff sit at a desk and answer phones, or are they organizers? We had to fight over this key idea of having teams of people in every workplace, and they are the ones empowered to organize the union. You know, Chicago and us call them CAP teams, contract action teams. But it's not like one person in the building is a union activist. You have to build a team and develop new leadership. We had people say, we can't do that. It's too much work. We can't ask people to do that. And then bargaining for the common good. So we put issues like affordable housing, immigrant rights, ending the random searches, cutting standardized testing, getting green space at every school. We put those into our contract fight. Those things are not allowed in our contract. Like, they're not mandatory subjects of bargaining. And so you had people in the union say, we'll lose on salary and health care if we add all this other stuff in. We can't do that. Our members need us to stick to the core issues. So as socialists, right, we had a different vision that actually the more this is a social justice strike, the more successful it's going to be. But we had to fight all of those things out. So I think I will say that there are a lot of challenges for socialists. Like, again, how do you continue to grow that rank and file leadership? And how do you actually grow the socialist movement through this work, which we haven't figured out yet.
Okay, so currently in DSA, there is a large debate over where to focus work, how to organize the unorganized, and whether socialists should focus on getting rank and file jobs or staff jobs, for example. What do you see as lessons of the teachers' strikes for these kinds of debates? And we'll start with Jillian.
Okay, so, I mean, I think that people probably already get the fact that if we want more people to join unions, the unions that exist have to be inspiring. And so I think probably the most important job of radicals is to actually be involved in transforming our unions to be inspiring. So just to give an example of the unorganized, charter school teachers, right? And charter school teachers were not really interested in the labor movement when it was very narrow, and you know, you've seen charter teachers join unions and going on strike in Chicago post the Chicago strike. There was a charter teacher strike in LA during our strike because people were like, hell yes, this is the kind of movement I want to be a part of. These unions are actually addressing the bigger picture. So that's one example. In terms of, you know, the question of staff and rank and file, you know, it wasn't a small thing that we had radicals come to work on the staff of UTLA. Like, that was very helpful. That was awesome. But I think being embedded in a workplace and a community, and learning to organize your coworkers and help people go through an experience of struggle as their coworker is kind of what being a socialist is all about. So if you think about, you know, if our goal is to increase like self-activity and self-confidence of working class people, like you, the best way you can do that is being part of that day-to-day with folks. Another thing is that I've often found that like you don't understand really what the political questions are of the members unless you're in the workplace. And so sometimes from a staffer point of view, it ends up being a question of numbers and meeting targets and so forth, and you miss out on, you know, what are the questions people really have right now, which you don't know unless you're in the workplace. Let's see, I think, you know, Eric mentioned how rank and file organizing created the conditions for what took place in West Virginia. I think that what made the Arizona strike really inspiring is that they also said, let's build a network of site activists to help lead the strike and to come out of this strike as a stronger union. And yeah, I think the last piece is probably around the potential for an alliance with the community that you build from the workplace level as well.
Yeah, so I think, just taking a step back, a lot of people in this room are probably socialists, I don't know, would be my guess. But if you think about it, we always make the case for the working class being the thing, right? But we haven't always had good examples to point to, and so it's worth noting that it might seem obvious, but the big thing, before we even talk about the tactics, is finally we have a lot of lived experience that we can point to show, like, actually, this is what happens. This is what happens when workers withhold their labor. You can win, you can transform and shut down cities and states. Now, you know, in the past we had to like point to, in 1919 this happened, you know, and it's good. You should read about the 1919 general strikes. You know, it's great stuff, but it's not something that necessarily felt relevant to a lot of workers, right? And I'll just say that if you looked at when the federal government shutdown ended, right, because flight attendants threatened to strike the next day, and because air traffic controllers called in sick, when they interviewed Sarah Nelson, the militant, hopeful future president of the AFL-CIO, they asked her, where did you come up with this idea for a strike to end the federal government shutdown? She says, well, look, if the teachers are doing it, why can't we? Right? And so I think this idea that the teachers are doing it, why can't we, is something we actually really need to hit on hard, because even within DSA, I'll be honest, I think there's a lot of like rhetorical gestures to the working class and not necessarily always an actual focus on deep organizing within the working class, which is two different things. And I think part of the argument we need to make then is like, look at what happens when you have groups of militants deeply embedded within unions and within strategic workplaces. And that's took a lot of work, you know, like 18 years of teaching, right? It's not easy, but there's no, what's that?
Hopefully it'll be a little easier now.
Okay, but hopefully a little bit easier now, yeah. But if you look at that, I think the case we need to make then is A, some industries are more strategic than others, like shutting down a school is more strategic than shutting down a coffee shop. You should organize coffee shops too, but as far as like where we focus our energies, it does make sense to do things like education, healthcare, logistics, right? Because just your bang for your buck for your limited amount of resources is more. As far as the question of how to organize the unorganized, which is another huge debate in DSA, I don't think you can do that without unions. These were strikes that even in red states were very weak. They did them in conjunction with the unions because they needed to be able to have the organizing capacity, right? And we need to be able to say, we need to organize the unorganized, but we're not gonna do that just as socialists alone. We need to do that in conjunction with our mass organizations. And in order to do that, we need to transform our unions, right? And I think that the exciting thing about this moment now is that radicals are winning back our unions. And I was just talking with Shira from Philly, so just keep your eye on Philly could be next. And it basically,
yes.
First we'll take over, but take back all of our teachers' unions and take over the labor movement as a whole. That's the plan, so let's do it.
All right.
Let's
all
friends.
Yeah, think big. Raise our expectations.
All right. So we'll start with Eric next. Last prompt will be, what will it take to spread and deepen the educators movement across our states and into states in the coming period? What are the opportunities, what are the obstacles, and how do we overcome them?
Cool, yeah, so this is the last question before we throw up to questions and comments as a whole. And obviously this is a huge question. I would say that the first thing we need to do is keep on winning. That's really important because Well, because the ability for the teacher strikes to continue to inspire depends on continued victories. And there's somewhat of a contradictory dynamic, because if you look at the reason West Virginia inspired so many people was because it was a really dramatic victory. It's not just they fought back, but they fought back and won, right? So people were like, what the hell? If they could do it, you know, why don't we try it here too? One of the interesting things now you see is that because Red for Ed has become normalized and teacher strikes in some ways have become a little bit more normalized, you have some of the traditional leaderships and bureaucracies and labor movements themselves feeling like, oh, we've got to get ahead of this thing, so we'll call a strike. You know, even if they haven't done deep organizing, even if they're not doing it on the kind of like broad messaging that can bring in the community. And so you're starting to see some strikes, like the New Haven strike recently, in the Bay Area, that wasn't particularly successful. It didn't really do a lot of deep organizing, and it just was focused kind of narrowly on wage demands. And the danger is that if you have some like muddled losses, then the union leadership is going to say, well, look, this is why we can't just rely on strikes. We need to go back to, like pleading with our friends in, the Democratic Party. And so I think that part of what we need to do then is to make sure when strikes happen, that we push them as far as they can go. I'd say also strike support is extremely important. Like, every time there's a strike of any workers in your locale, this should be like organizing number one for all socialists. Like, go all out, be at the picket line, get everyone you can as much as possible, because the stakes of what happens to them is huge for everyone as a whole. So we need to keep on winning. The second thing we need to do is, I think, put at the fore progressive taxation. We need to make the rich pay. And this is like not happening as much as we should. Our statewide level organizing is more limited than it should be. The progressive taxation, unless we can make the rich pay, then one of the dynamics you're going to have is teachers can win some pay raises, and then they're going to slash it from other social services. That just happened in Washington right now, right? In which teachers make wages gains, and then the state says, well, look, this is what happens, so you better probably reconsider going on strike, everyone else, because you got to come from somewhere. So we need to challenge this narrative that there's not enough to go around. And I'll just, the last thing I'll say, and part of that raising expectations, is, to be honest, we have this incredible moment right now because there's somebody running for president who's putting at the fore the fight against privatization, the fight against the billionaires. And the fact is that the Bernie Sanders campaign is giving a platform to the most militant teachers right now, literally in Houston. The NEA Teachers Association is meeting, and Bernie just met with the radical wing to talk about what they're going to do to keep on organizing their strikes. And that radical wing, literally as we speak, I'm getting text, is pushing for a resolution amongst the 8,000 delegates there, saying that the NEA should have a democratic vote to let its members decide on who gets their endorsement for president, right? And so the question of Bernie is not about Bernie. The question of Bernie is, how do we use this opening to organize a class struggle wing within the labor movement that can fight for strikes and that can fight for independence from the Democratic Party establishment? And the fact is, the whole establishment is trying to destroy it, and also gives us a good opportunity to go out and talk socialism and politics with literally hundreds of thousands of people. So if any of you want to get involved, come talk to me after.
Awesome. It's a huge, huge question, but I'll try to be concise. So as far as what's next, Eric referenced the issue of progressive taxation and a statewide struggle. So in blue states, we have this incredibly narrow history of just organizing our own contract with our own district, when the funding questions and the legal questions of privatization, right, the complete allowance of charter schools to take over our districts, that's decided at the state level. In California, we have no history of actually mobilizing mass action at the state level, so that's a thing that we got to figure out. But we have this opportunity to take on corporate power next year with the Schools and Communities First Act, which is to finally end Prop 13's property tax loophole for corporations. Prop 13 is why California went from top in spending to 44th in the nation. So Disneyland, for example, is paying property taxes on what their property was worth in like 1980. So that's why we don't have money for our schools. We're trying to split it so that homeowners aren't affected, but that corporations pay the property tax based on what their massive properties are actually worth. It's gonna be a hell of a fight. We're gonna need everybody's help on that. So that's one thing we're gonna work on. The second thing I just wanted to bring up as far as what's next is to actually continue thinking about unions for the common good, right? How do we deepen this question of unions are not just about the, some narrow things that are in our contract, but that we have that workers' power ability to raise these broader issues. In LA, we are fighting for our union to fight for this initiative next year called Reform LA, which takes money out of jails and puts it into healthcare, housing, and jobs. And that's just one way. And educators closing the camps, let's talk about this. What are we gonna do to get educators more involved in that fight? The third thing, it is definitely this, dialectical dynamic where both, you know, Bernie's campaign and the strikes have completely raised expectations about what a national program for education should look like, right? There's huge issues that are now out there in a national conversation about what do schools need and deserve. And I think one thing that we have to be aware of, I know in my union, the slogan is, let's turn our strike power into political power. And I think what we have to be aware of is there's two ways you could really go with that. One is like, okay, we're done striking, let's do politics the way our unions have always done politics, which is bad. Which doesn't engage anybody new, right? Which focuses on high propensity voters, which ends up voting for the lesser evil, right? We gotta think about what happens if Bernie gets a nomination and what happens if he doesn't, and what will that mean for our unions? What will people conclude? And so we actually also have to transform how our unions do politics, or this political opening people won't really be able to take advantage of it. That kind of made me think about another danger there, which is that we just get involved in politics and sort of stop building toward the next strike, which is what drove this political opening in the first place, right? And in the mass strike, Rosa Luxemburg has this really powerful point where she says, you know, a lot of times you think that, like, to radicalize, we go from the economic struggle and then the political struggle is the higher form of it. But it actually has to do both, right? We actually, as unions, the two feed each other, right? Political inspiration and big horizons about some of the things like that are in Bernie's platform are very radical, and I hopefully will raise people's expectations. But what it's going to take to fight for that is actually more shop floor power, right? Stronger unions at our work site, and we actually have to go back and, because post strike in LA. It's not all roses. A lot of people were demoralized. A lot of people are like, shit, we gotta go back to work and it's still really, really hard. So how are we building the next layer of leaders who can also fight the boss at the school and begin to take back our schools and then take back our cities and beyond? I think that's it.
Thank you both so much again. So now we're going to open it up to the floor a bit of an open format. If you would like to speak, ask a question, or make commentary or anything like that, just raise your hand. I will put you on stack. There's a microphone right here. Wow, that's a lot of hands. Okay, so let's begin with Lady in the Core t-shirt. And maybe a few people at a time can come up to the mic. And then the person in the black shirt right here, and then this gentleman in the red shirt up here. What's that? Yeah, so Sarah is taking time. It's about 3 minutes. We're asking about 3 minutes for questions and commentary. There will be a timer, and I may have to stop here going for too long. But
okay, my name is Katie. I am a member of the Chicago Teachers Union and a member of CORE. Jillian, I want to speak exactly to what you were talking to right at the end there. What do we do after a strike? I know people always clap when we talk about CORE and the teachers union, and I think we should, because 2012 was an amazing moment. However, what happened after 2012 within Chicago? We saw the ruling class come back and they kicked our ass. All right, and I want to make sure people understand that. When you rise up, they will come for you. We saw 50 schools close the year after the strike. We saw massive budget cuts. We've seen attacks on special education. And we need to be prepared for that. We've also seen kind of the usual, I was just in the talk, Barry's talk earlier about the rank and file strategy. And we've seen
you know, how, what happens after you get elected in this, when reform caucuses get elected. We've seen those struggles rise up within CTU. How, just exactly what you're talking about, that we have not done as good a job as we need to do in organizing the rank and file to mobilize our members into action, and we have not been able to exercise that strike muscle. Our last contract, we did not go on strike, and it's still hurting us today. We also, you know, our staff is demoralized. We are in a contract fight right now. We're talking about getting ready for a strike by the fall. I'm on the bargaining team, you know, I'm involved with this, but our membership is not ready. And the question then becomes, you know, how do we keep things going? We put a lot of our eggs in the electoral political basket. We've done a lot of investing in progressive politicians that are going to, you know, be on our side, and I think there's definitely a place for that. But we did it at the expense of the deep mobilizing that we need to be doing. So I do want us to kind of keep some of these questions in mind as we're talking. And I also want to talk a little bit about, you know, what was actually won. You talked about members going back and being demoralized, because the reality is you don't win everything in a strike. In one strike. And so to also talk about, you know, what can socialists be doing to actually push these strikes? You know, we've kind of got, there's kind of a set strategy now. You go on strike for about 5 to 7 days and then you come back, right? And like, what is, you know, what is the socialist roles to actually push that beyond? Like, what can we be doing to, you know, to win more and bigger and better? Thanks.